You're tuning in to Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. James Ivers, a former slave, enlisted as a Union Army soldier during the Civil War in Cape Girardeau. He died shortly after, leaving behind his wife Harriet, a former slave, their children, and his legacy. And now, decades later, the Cape Girardeau City Council voted to memorialize him by renaming the historic Common Pleas Courthouse Park to Ivers Square. Dr. Stephen Hoffman, professor of history and coordinator of the Historic Preservation Program at Southeast Missouri State University, joins me to talk about the life of James Ivers.
It came to be out of a process of thinking about memorialization, and particularly the lack of memorialization for the African-American community in Cape Girardeau. The issue first came up when I was speaking with a colleague of mine, Dr. Wayne Bowen, in the Department of History, and he's also on the city council, and they were in the process of naming a street in the new industrial park. And so it occurred to him, were there streets named after African Americans? And we couldn't think of any. We couldn't think of any public buildings. And there had been a school named after an African American educator, but that school burned down. And so we started thinking then, you know, what were the opportunities? And, you know, the city doesn't build new streets very often, but, you know, we've been having roundabouts and, you know, kind of what would be an authentic kind of naming opportunity. At the same time, you know, who would be an appropriate person, you know, from the community? And I think that a lot of times you see naming opportunities for, you know, national figures. A lot of communities have a Martin Luther King Boulevard, for example, and I think that's a great thing. But Martin Luther King, although we influenced what happened in Cape Girardeau, he never actually came to Cape Girardeau. And so we wanted something more authentic. We knew about Denise Lincoln's research into the African-American Civil War soldiers. And so we started having conversations with her about what their experience was, and tried to identify someone who had connections to Cape Girardeau. And that led us to James Ivers, who was an enslaved person here in Cape Girardeau, and he worked, had a family. Initially, like many slave families, his wife was owned by a different owner. They were married, they had children, but they lived separately. They were eventually united prior to the outbreak of the Civil War. And but during the war, Cape Girardeau became a Union outpost, and the Court of Common Pleas was a provost marshal's headquarters. And when the opportunity for black enlistment became available, Mr. Ivers, on the very first day, signed up and joined the Union Army in order to fight for his freedom. And we thought that that was a great emblematic act, both of individual courage, but also representative for the community as a whole.
Now let's talk about this courthouse. Historically speaking, what is its history?
So it's a Court of Common Pleas. Cape Girardeau is a little odd, I guess, in that it's had up until today, sort of two courthouses. That the county seat is in Jackson, but Cape Girardeau is on the river. So there are a couple other places. I want to say there were like maybe four counties where they had this separate Court of Common Pleas, and so Cape Girardeau is one of them. This particular courthouse was built, I want to say 1854, kind of in the 1850s, and then it was expanded in the 1890s, and then again in 1959. So the courthouse we see today is really the result of kind of these three construction periods.
Now, when we're looking at that whole thing, where does Cape Girardeau fall in line when we're talking about the Civil War?
Right. Well, so it wasn't actually a Confederate state. It was a slaveholding state.
Okay.
And so most of the other slaveholding states seceded, but the border states of Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri did not. And although I'm not a Civil War expert, you know, my understanding is that, you know, Lincoln, you know, was very clear that he needed to keep the border states, you know, in the Union. So Missouri's story is really kind of complicated because it does not secede, but it is slaveholding. And so a lot of people, when they talk about the Civil War and slavery and its abolition, you know, they talk about the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves. Well, technically, the proclamation freed the slaves that were in rebel control, were in, you know, so all the slaves that Lincoln had power over or in the territory that the Union controlled were not affected by it. It was only in the territory that was not under Union control. And so the slaves in Missouri, of course, would not have been freed by that act. It was not until the passage of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery that slavery in Missouri was ended. So this complicated a history of being a slaveholding state, but still in the Union, in a war that ultimately becomes a war against slavery, means that, you know, it's complicated.
So what happens to James Ivers after the war has ended? What happens to him?
Well, unfortunately for James Ivers, he does not see the end of the war. James Ivers takes his freedom into his own hands, and he walks into that courthouse, and he enlists, and he goes into service, and unfortunately he dies of disease, which in the Civil War, many, many, many people died of disease. So this was an unfortunate occurrence for him. But even though he dies in the war, that's not, his story doesn't die. And that's part of what we really thought was powerful about this story and the representation that it holds for us, for the contributions of the African American community, because he wasn't just an individual; he was a husband and a father, and he gave up the comfort of his family to enlist, to fight for his freedom. And even though he died, his wife was able to get a pension. In order to get that pension, she had to have the support of people in the community. Enslaved African Americans were not able to be married, and yet there's a folk tradition of marriage, and James and Harriet were married in that folk tradition, and that was attested to by their previous owners, and so Harriet had people help her negotiate the process of getting a Union soldier's pension, and that process took quite a while, but it was successful, and then she was able to take the money that she got from the pension to purchase property here in Cape Girardeau, over by the old Second Baptist Church, and so she bought a home, raised her family, was a contributing member of the community that helped shape Cape Girardeau in the post-war years. So by naming the square James and Harriet Ivers Square, we really wanted to focus on sort of the family, the individual courage, but also the family component of it, and the tenacity of African Americans to create a place for themselves, even in a world that would enslave them if it could.
So you're seeing equality in a sense for the first time in this way. She had to prove her worth to people, and she benefited from the sacrifice that her husband made.
Absolutely.
She was, to some degree, considered a human when at that time you had to prove it, and you weren't technically seen as a human.
That's right. And I think that kind of bridging that transition from slavery to freedom, and I would say that not only did Harriet benefit from the actions of her husband, kind of in the, you know, in the micro scale, mm-hmm. But the community as a whole, because part of what makes our community strong are when we have people who are invested in it, who buy homes, who raise their families, and that sort of investment in the future is really, you know, you have individuals, you have individual families, but they create communities. You know, the communities then are what create the city as a whole. And so I think that when we look around today, we see the outcome of this kind, you know, this series of acts.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation on the renaming of the historic Common Pleas Courthouse Park to Ivor Square with Dr. Stephen Hoffman, Professor of History and Coordinator of the Historic Preservation Program at Southeast Missouri State University, right here on KRCU.
Hi, I'm Ari Shapiro. Love what you hear on your car radio, but don't love your car anymore? Well, donate it to us. Your car can be turned into the programs you love. Here's how.
Visit krcu.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. If you're just now tuning in, my guest, Dr. Stephen Hoffman, Professor of History and Coordinator of the Historic Preservation Program at Southeast Missouri State University, and I were talking about the renaming of the Common Pleas Courthouse Park after a former slave who enlisted in the Union Army during the Civil War. Cape Girardeau is taking a different approach to a nationwide trend where you're seeing lots of Confederate memorials being removed completely, taken elsewhere. And Cape Girardeau is just simply renaming it. And in Missouri, there was a Confederate memorial in Forest Park that has started being dismantled as we mm-hmm. speak. Are these Confederate memorials problematic, or should they just be somewhere else in society? Should removal of history be something that we should be doing?
As a historian, I am against the removing of history. I think it's important for us to know where we've been. And Cape Girardeau also has a Confederate memorial. And our Confederate memorial, as it turns out, is now located at James and Harriet Ivor Square. It was not placed there by the community. It was originally placed by the old bridge to Southern Illinois, and it was constructed in 1931 is when that was established. We also have a memorial to the Union soldiers that was established in 1908 at the courthouse square. So I think that the United States has a complicated history, and Cape Girardeau, which has a history of being under the Spanish and being under the French and being under the Americans and then being America, you know, has a complicated story. And we have a complicated story as it relates to different European ethnic groups. We have a complicated story in terms of Native American. And we have a complicated story with African Americans. And I think that the more we know about those complicated stories, the better off that we are. And so, although I guess I would say I'm anti-Confederate, you know, I'm not a Confederate sympathizer, but there are people in this area who whose ancestors fought for the Confederacy. And I think that it's important to recognize that. And I think that the memorial Two, these memorials, they don't just like fall out of the sky. They are not erected in the immediate aftermath of the conflict. It's not, these are not cemetery markers that, oh my gosh, I lost somebody I loved, here's a memorial. These come about later as part of a process of not only reinterpreting what the war was about, but reinterpreting what America stands for. And a lot of these Confederate memorials come about as part of the efforts to firmly establish white supremacy in a Jim Crow period. They're not just that, but they are that. And I think that that complicated tension we see, I mean, that's nuanced, and nuances don't play well when either you're looking at a news account or you're upset because young people are dying at the hands of police, and you know, what does this monument mean? And I understand all that. So, but as a historian, what I would like to see us do is really to reinterpret, to provide interpretation for these Confederate memorials. And
what do you mean by that?
So there's a the Atlanta History Center has a, I think, a model for moving forward, where they're really providing some language to try to help people reinterpret these monuments, and so they have this kind of template and some language from that. They have, you know, introduction, and I don't need to do all that. But one of the lines that really struck me, and I'd like to share with you, is to say, this monument was created to recognize the dedication and sacrifice of Americans who fought to establish the Confederate slaveholding republic. And I think that we have people in our region that their relatives did that. And they don't want that to be erased. But then the language goes on, yet this monument must now remind us that their loss actually meant liberty, justice, and freedom for millions of people, a legacy that continues for all of us today. So to be able to, when you look at that monument, see language that puts it in context, that says, this thing happened in our past. We had this schism. We had this great war. We had people on both sides of it. And this side lost, and that loss meant this side won, and the gains of freedom for millions of human beings is powerful, and it's not to call out the dead for being wrong necessarily, but to contextualize in a broader way instead of just saying, if we didn't have the monument here, we wouldn't have to think about that. The problem with the uninterpreted Confederate memorials is that the implication is this is a great thing. Robert E. Lee, great American hero. Well, what did he stand for? Wait a minute. That, you know, that operates against my interest. Why would you be celebrating that? Well, if we contextualize it to say, hey, he did these things, and his losing means these people had freedom. Okay, well, I understand he had a family, and they're sad that he's gone, and he was wrong. You know, as a person who's been wrong a time or two in my life, you know, I think that that it's okay for us to allow reminders of that to still be here, as long as it is in context, as long as we know that that it's not a celebration, that the people who erected our monument in 1931, it was moved to the courthouse in 1995, I think not for any particular purpose other than that the bridge was undergoing change and they had to move it somewhere, and why not put it with the other monuments? They erected it in defense of white supremacy. I think it's useful to know that, and I think it's okay for us to say in 1931 there was a group strong enough to memorialize this, and in 2017 there was a group strong enough to memorialize the contributions of African-American soldiers and their widows to freedom for many and opportunity for our community.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
That's our show. You can find my entire conversation with Dr. Stephen Hoffman, professor of history and coordinator of the Historic Preservation Program at Southeast Missouri State University, at krcu.org, or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.